Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We're halfway through Madison's comments regarding the Assumption Act, and I hope you're starting to understand that when it really came down to what was in the Constitution and how things were perceived, well, there was definitely a disparity, because there were some, actually very specifically, Hamilton, who started trying to play implications. Oh, well, because we got that, it's almost like, as Iredell went through the ratification debates and pointed out, have you ever heard of a power of attorney that gave somebody the power to sell lands in Answell, and because you had lands in Coswell as well, that they could assume that they could sell those lands, because it's kind of implied. You're giving them their ability to sell lands. No, very specific powers, and they're delineated in a very specific way. Not to be able to just assume debt, the debt that they're to assume. Let me be clear here. As Nicholas said in the ratification debates, if it is not within the enumerated powers, they cannot make a treaty regarding it. Now, if you're creating a debt, then that debt has to be within those enumerated powers that you're taking on this money so that you can spend it on something. If you're taking on debt to help a state bail itself out financially, that's not an enumerated power. The federal government does not have an enumerated power to bail out a state, to bail out a business, to bail out a local area because of a natural disaster, as noble and as nice as it is. As George Washington said in his farewell address, it is those customary things that cause government to be overran. I mean, they are basically the footstools that they use to basically overpower government and or pervert, subvert, and destroy governments. I think the word destroy government is technically what he said. So when we look at trying to get and play around with the nuances to give the federal government a little bit more power, as Mr. Hamilton was really trying to do so, well, it seems to be that he was really stretching things. He was obviously causing problems. And in a way, I know for a fact that Hamilton would not be happy with the outcome of his efforts, because I don't think he really wanted to see America become communist and take away liberties. But he's got to take ownership. And I bet you he's rolling around in his grave, owning the fact that he was the one that actually instituted some of these paradigms that we're dealing with today, implied powers and so forth. As you know, the show is sponsored by RepublicReview.org as well as ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. You are listening to the only show that goes through the academic evidence and evidence-based solutions. And we have a comment line, 425-270-5416. And actually, I have a comment, and I will get to that comment once we've gotten through this content that I've kind of already told you about. Because bottom line, we're trying to focus on one thing. And when I start going down and dealing with comments and answering those types of things, it allows me to go down into a different myopic path or on a very specific subject. And so we had a gentleman by the name of Charles call. He's left a message. I've got that to play for you. However, as I've said, what we want to do is we want to get through the Assumption Act. And what we also want to do is get through the cod fishery bounties. Then we want to cover Madison's essays on property, and then we want to cover the Whiskey Rebellion. And at that point, we're going to take a break, get into more marketing, and this is when we'll cover the comments. And the way things have been going, and I apologize about last week, when you hear a rerun play, that there's either something's come up, something such as my internet's down and I can't actually broadcast, or if you hear nothing at all, there's a likelihood that we've had a denial of service because we've been hit before by denials of service. That would point towards China and nefarious organizations like that. They love just hacking, and they're hacking around in America. Don't think that they're not knocking on your door. And as a matter of fact, I've had some veterans make some pretty, you know, expressive comments regarding, you know, something in the wire and so forth. But I am here to tell you that we are under assault because it is a wild, wild west frontier or warfare that we're dealing with when it comes to cyber crime and hacking and those types of things. So anyway, like I said, we'll get into those comments and hopefully I'll have Charles actually be able to dial in. We'll actually have a short interview or conversation. But what I want to do is I actually want to kind of lay some things out here because I know it's been a long time since I've kind of walked through what we're really doing, why we're really doing this. I know this is really important, and I hope you are garnering how important it is to hear what Madison said and not me paraphrase or basically say, well, this is what he said, and just accept it. I believe it's important that you actually hear the words from these men's mouths, that you hear what they say specifically. I don't want to put words in their mouth, and I don't want to put words in your head to think otherwise. Because what I want you to do is realize and actually get, you know, get this epiphany that this is, Republic Review is exactly, is the only process that we have in making this thing happen and getting the federal government back into compliance. Any other way is a political compromise. And I'll give you the first political compromise that this nation had to deal with, which was slavery. It caused problems within the Constitution. It caused problems throughout our generations of both races, culture, and all sorts of things that has just made a mess, has cost us hundreds of thousands of lives, billions and billions of dollars, probably trillions of dollars, and it won't finish. It will never be done because of that compromise. I don't see it in our lifetime. I see people starting to finally wake up and say, you know what? Isn't it time we just moved on? If you realize the Constitution does not allow you to revisit the past, reparations is unconstitutional. It's the same thing as an ex post facto law, something that was legal at one point in time, and all of a sudden and now we're going to pay and fine and compensate somebody because, well, we considered that a crime and it's illegal and or a bad thing we did. Well, you can't do that. Ex post facto laws are unconstitutional. Both the government and state are prohibited from those things. So what do? You got to move on. Maybe we try that Christian principle of forgiving because, you know, if you really want to think about it, who owes the apology first? Well, the first really well-documented records of slavery, well, where does that go to? I mean, Egypt. Egypt had the longest run of slave labor under any other form of government. I mean, just the Jews themselves, how long were they enslaved by Egypt? Well, we know 400 years. There were others who were also enslaved. And the point is that are we going to go historically and do the FIFO, first in, first out? Okay. Well, then there's a lot of African countries and a lot of African cultures and people throughout the world from Africa that I think owe Israel a huge apology. Now, I don't know about their constitution, but I do know that there's this desire of reparations. But in all honesty, truly, the righteous doesn't want reparations. They want their liberty, and they want to be able to begin living their lives. Franklin Douglas, he wasn't asking, let us live our lives. As a matter of fact, he complained during the Reconstruction era because we were holding them back. When you're handing out things, when you're giving things and coming along and helping, you may think you're helping. Get out of the way and let people do what they believe is best for themselves instead of you coming along saying, we think you need this. It's very condescending and it is manipulative. And at best, it is unconstitutional because, again, just like the Assumption Act, we may not have the power and authority to actually bail people out at any point or for any reason. So I do understand we do have treaties. We have the power of creating treaties. But we have to be really careful that we maintain the spirit of individual liberty, individual sovereignty that is baked within the Constitution. Because when we start doing things and stepping on that spirit by handouts and welfare and those types of things. And this is why we got to get into the cod fishery bounties, because Madison just basically uses sensationalism regarding welfare. Anyway, I do know that we're going to have a super, super strawberry moon on Thursday this week. So if you're inclined and you look at the heavenly bodies, then you might find that this Thursday's your moonrise might be a little spectacular. I think there's a reason why they call it strawberry instead of blood, because, you know, that blood is more of a biblical, so they've kind of moved away from that. Anyway, as we go into the break, when we come back, we will be covering the Assumption Acts and Madison's comments. We'll be right back after these two promos. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL. Or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me kind of take off at the beginning of the paragraph that we just left off in. And this is, again, Madison talking about the Assumption Acts and trying to go through the logic of what they're doing and some of the scenarios that they're looking at or looking into. And this is what he says. If, during the war, she, a state, has made as great exertions and as has suffered as much as any of the other states. If she has, since the peace, paid her full proportion of the supplies to the federal treasury, at the same time exerting herself to the utmost to discharge her state debt. And if finally she will probably be found to be in advance to the Union and would therefore, if justice could at once be done, be now entitled to a reimbursement. But what must be said by the citizens of that state if instead of a reimbursement, they are called upon to make further advances. Sir, I may add here that their contributions to the Federal Treasury under the proposed system of revenue will exceed the ratio by which they would contribute. In other words, they're violating the Constitution based on apportionment by taxes laid in proportion to the representation. I do not wish to extend this investigation any further than has already been done. But where do I do it? The evidence would be more striking that the payments from those parts of the union that would receive least benefit from the assumption would be greater than those that would receive the immediate benefit. One of my colleagues seems to be of opinion that the measure would be favorable to the interest of Virginia, but he seems to me to have grounded his opinion on the erroneous supposition that the proposed plan will embrace the whole of the debts as they existed at the close of the war, or that the state of Virginia will contribute less on the plan deriving revenue from consumption than she would if derived according to the constitutional ratio. I believe, on the contrary, that if the assumption should take place as originally proposed, there would be a calm on Virginia for $5 million, whereas if there is no assumption, her citizens will have to provide for about $3 million only, and thus instead of bearing her proper burden, which is about 1/7, she would have to bear a burden in the ratio of 1/5. He seems to think that his own particular district would be benefited by this measure, but if he be right in his opinion, then that part of the state will consume more of the other parts. He will find, sir, that instead of relieving his constituents compared to the rest of the state, he would still more augment their burdens. So it would come to at last that the state would have to pay $5 million instead of $3 million. And that the particular part of the state he represents, instead of paying their proportion of $3 million, would have to pay more than their proportion of $5 million. I admit, however, that he is the most proper judge on that subject, but the citizens of Virginia would not only be called upon when already in advance and to an amount beyond their proper ratio, but in a mode that is peculiarly obnoxious to them. I mean that of excise. Sir, the people of that state are as adverse to excises as those of any other state can be to direct taxes. And in my own judgment, with far more reason, where that the article exercised is or excise is not by a peculiar fee or is not particularly free from the common objections. Excises are unequal with respect to different parts of the union. They are also unequal to various parts of the same state. This mode of collection gives arbitrary powers to the collectors and exposes our citizens to vexatious searches. It opens a door to frauds and perjuries that tends equally to vitiate the morals of the people and to defeat the public revenue. Besides, sir, excises are more expensive in the collection than other kinds of taxes. The collection of the excise in Great Britain costs 10%. That of our direct taxes is computed at 3% only. I will not positively say that the similar disproportion in the expense of collecting would be incurred in this country, but in some parts of it, I am sure that the expense of excises would be greatest on some articles view, would if the collection were made at exceed the revenue obtained from it. Sir, there's been an argument of another kind advanced in some support of assumption. Gentlemen have thought it a matter of conscience that not only justice should be done, that the condition of the people should be equalized, that no invidious equalizer, they're talking about equality here, folks, equality outcome, and those, I mean, these are not good things. These are socialism.
Anyway, that no invidious comparison might be made between the inhabitants of one state and those of another, and that no oppressions or embarrassments should force the people to immigrate from one state to another, like people are leaving California. It would be a comfortable reflection if every part of the union could be assimilated in this instance. But, sir, I think we have no authority to sacrifice essential considerations to obtain these advantages. Nor do I know that we should obtain them by assuming the state debts. Supposing that measure to be adopted, let us reflect, that would be the situation of different parts of the union. I do not at this moment consider the question as it respects justice, right, or general policy, but in reference merely to the particular consequences of equalizing the circumstances of the people. Let us take a view comparatively to the people of the United States. Massachusetts owes a debt of several millions. The public debt, when you come to analyze it, at least where it is due to the citizens and not to foreigners, is a debt from one part of the people to another. The government is the collector from the pockets of the debtors to pay it into the hands of the creditors. If, sir, the state debts be assumed, Massachusetts will then get rid of her embarrassment, but would be the situation of Virginia. Besides her public debt, I believe her citizens owe one to another debts in amount equal to the whole public debt of Massachusetts, perhaps. I may say to the amount of both the public and the private debts to the state. In addition to all this, the people of Virginia are indebted to foreigners to a greater amount than their whole debt of Massachusetts. Sir, I firmly believe that through Virginia, though Virginia is less oppressed with public debt than Massachusetts, yet when we take a view of all the difficulties she labors under and weigh them against those of Massachusetts, it will be found that Virginia ought to be relieved herself instead of being expected to relieve others. But supposing all objections are another nature to be laid aside, I freely confess that after a more minute examination into the subject, I am much inclined to doubt whether the assumption can possibly be carried into execution. Difficulties are continually arising when I survey this question, for which I can find no solution without departing from every principle by which we ought to be guided. It never yet has been shown in what manner a remedy could be provided for a partial subscription. Suppose the state creditors were part of them to subscribe and part to refuse. Suppose those of one state subscribe and those of another not. Again, sir, by what method will you discriminate the debts that come under the definition from those that will be excluded by it? Where will you invest this important discretionary power? I really think that the great difficulties will be found before this can be effected. There is another objection, too, to which I have never heard a satisfactory answer, although it has been repeatedly urged by a member from Georgia. There are debts existing in some of the states that do not bear interest that could have got into circulation without any title to it, and have been received by the present holders without any other expectation than that in some reasonable time the principal would be paid. Would it, sir, be proper or necessary to consider these debts of the union bearing interest or to provide for the immediate funding of them? There is a case, in my opinion, far more difficult. I mean paper money issued to redeem the state's debts. The state of North Carolina has taken up its certificates with these paper bills. They are not proposed to be included in the assumption. They are clearly excluded by the present motion. Yet, they are as much a state debt to be sunk by taxes as certificates, and the taxes may as much interfere with those of other states. Some of the states, sir, have not only assumed debts recommended by Congress for making the depreciation to the Army,
but they have gone further and have made up the depreciation where it was not recommended. Other states have not done this. The debts existing in some states, I take it for granted, comprehend these depreciation notes. Would it not be unjust to call on those states that have not made this provision for their army that other states have done? Would it not be hard to call upon those officers and soldiers who have not received this additional compensation to pay for those states who have? Okay, so we're stopping there real quick. And then when we come back, we will, it looks like we'll hopefully wrap up in the next segment, Madison's comments. When we're all said and done, what ends up happening will actually, it'll just show you the dangers of political compromise. You got to live by the compact, you got to live by the Constitution to the letter of the law. We'll be right back.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. All right, so let's wrap this up because I think we got maybe a paragraph left. I would not here be understood to censor the states that made this compensation. I rather commend them for it. It is proof of their magnanimity and justice that does them honor. But at the same time, this does not alter the nature of the objection. In some states, in order to reward the army, they have done it by several aids that do not constitute any part of the state debts. In some of the states, they are debts still unliquidated. If you declare that when liquidated, they shall be assumed, you afford a temptation that has been hitherto cautiously avoided, that of making states less exact in the statements of their accounts. I do not find any gentleman has proposed. On the contrary, most of them seem to have rejected the idea of making provision at this session for fulfilling the engagement in case we enter into an assumption. I think it would be a powerful and unanswerable objection against assuming the state debts at this time that we do not see or are not prepared to decide on the means of providing for them. There is not a more important and fundamental principle in legislation than that of the ways and means ought always to face the public engagements.
that our approbation should ever go hand in hand with our promises to say that the United States should be answerable for $25 million without knowing whether the ways and means can be provided and without knowing whether those who are to succeed us will think with us on the subject would be rash and unjustifiable. In my opinion, it would be hazarding the public faith in a manner contrary to every idea of prudence. It is very true, sir, that a variety of funds have been proposed, yet they are nothing more than mere suggestions. And though I think they are as good as could be expected in the time, I really believe that some of them, at least if they can be carried into execution at all, will disappoint the calculations on which they are founded. I cannot finish my observations on this subject, sir, without adverting to one particular, which I would wish gentlemen to attend to, not so much as for our sakes as for their own. I would recommend to them no longer to assume a preeminence over us in the nationality of their motives, and that they would forbear those frequent assertions that if the state debts are to be provided for, the federal debts shall also go unprovided for. Nay, if the state debts are not assumed, the Union will be endangered. Sir, I am persuaded that if the gentlemen knew the motives that govern us, they would blush at such an intemperate as well as an inconsistent language. I am sure that if they knew the emotions with which it was heard, they would at least see the inutility of it. I hope, sir, that whatever may be the decision on this question of assumption, that patriotism and every other noble and generous motive will give the minority to acquiesce in measures which will tend to establish public credit by a due provision for the public engagements. And then he closes there. And so it wasn't done. These were just debates. They were going back and forth and so forth. However, something was going on. And as you look at this, this all started within the very first session, the very first year of Congress. And what ended up happening was the compromise. And if I remember correctly, this started like, when was this, the fall of 89, when they kind of got into this. And so the compromises actually occurred in April, or actually the end results of the compromise occurred in April. And when I'm talking about the compromise, there was a compromise that had been done between three men. This was a political compromise because it was well recognized by Jefferson that Hamilton and Madison and himself really had a influence on everybody, their decisions, and the directions that they would go. Madison was revered as really understanding, and it was like the great mentor for all these proteges on what is constitutional. Even George Washington went to Madison and had him write anything that he made as a public statement, like thanking Congress. I mean, at the very beginning of Washington's term, of his first term, Madison literally wrote Washington's response to Congress and then Congress's response back to Washington. I mean, he was playing on both sides, but he did it with such just humility, sincerity, however you want to put it. But it was just amazing of the depth of this man in not taking advantage. Many of men would have taken advantage of their influence, like Hamilton later proved himself when Washington started trusting Hamilton over Madison. But anyway, on June 20th, now this is a kind of a write-up written by Jay Kratz, who basically posted this out on the web, but this is a really good condensed dialogue of what happened in this compromise. On June 20th, 1790, now if you understand, the first session began
1789 in May, so they hadn't even had a year under their belt, but they were already talking about assuming all the state debts and so forth. When Congress was temporarily meeting in New York City, Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson hosted a dinner. In attendance were Secretary of Treasury Alexander Hamilton and a representative from Virginia named James Madison. Keep in mind, these men were on opposing ends of the political spectrum. Hamilton, a Federalist, wanted the federal government to hold the bulk of the political and economic power. Madison and Jefferson, Republicans, wanted that power to remain with the states. Nonetheless, the three men met to discuss a prolonged deadlock in Congress, and this meeting was a pivotal turn in what was known as the Compromise of 1790 regarding the Assumption Act. Back in January 1790, Hamilton had given his first report on the public credit to Congress. One of the most contentious issues in the report was Hamilton's recommendation that the federal government assume the state's substantial Revolutionary War debts. Hamilton believed this was necessary to establish the United States credit and promote investments. Furthermore, the debt rested in the hands of a small number of wealthy citizens. Hamilton knew these men would take a keen interest in the success of a country that owed them money. The assumption issue had been debated in Congress for months. Northern members supported it because they owed that much, because their debts were largely unpaid. But Southern members, including Madison, opposed it because Southern states had paid off a significant portion of their debt. At the same time, Congress had been at a standstill over the location of the permanent capital. So see, they were supposed to figure out where Washington, D.C. was supposed to be. Although the Constitution mandated a seat of the federal government, it had not specified an exact location. Congress, over the course of its first year, had considered more than a dozen potential locations. The Funding Act, as introduced by the Senate, June 1790, and the Funding Act bill version, which was also in the Senate, when these senators, Pierce, Butler, and South Carolina, presented a new residence bill on May 31, 1790, he left the location blank. The deadlock continued into June when the Senate failed to pass a motion to fill the spot with Easterly Bank of the Potomac. Subsequent motions designated Baltimore, Maryland, and Wilmington, Delaware, also failed. Hence the dinner meeting. Key was a bargain in which Madison agreed not to block the assumption of the state debt and convince enough Southern members to support it. Now, this is what he's saying. I don't believe he supported it. I believe he changed his tone. Not to support it, but he basically just stopped rallying against it and arguing of its constitutionality. In exchange, Congress would first pass legislation locating the capital city on the Potomac after a 10-year temporary move to Philadelphia. This may be one of the earliest examples of legislative log rolling or vote trading in Congress. Although there was no dispute that this meeting took place, historians have skeptically to what extent it had on the eventual compromise. Now, I have heard this story that it was Madison who hosted the meeting, not Jefferson. Nonetheless, the fact is that there is enough evidence that proves that these three men got together and that Jefferson was very quick when the decision was made to actually go in and speculatively purchase and took debt to buy land in the Virginia portion of the District of Columbia. And so, as you can see, there are compromises that kind of motivate people to doing things. And in this particular case, the Assumption Act, even though Madison argued and argued and argued against it, it was very clear that Madison actually, when it came down to the prodding of Jefferson, he was moved to say, okay, I will maintain my moral integrity and I won't support this, but
I will not fight it either publicly so that it can move forward. And so there you go. We have another political compromise. We'll be right back.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.addlocal.com. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so closing, just on the Assumption Act itself, just on what happened. As far as I see it, there were a lot of little problems. Now, Madison never really brought up the uniformity. He alluded to it, but he never used the term very specifically. That, if, you know, the debt and that the taxes and that the manner in which the federal government is supposed to deal with the states, they're supposed to deal with them in a uniform function, in a uniform manner based on apportionment. So if the apportionment across the United States is a $5 tax per head, per apportionment, then some states would be paying more based on the population and some states would be paying less, but it would be managed at equal proportion. And so in going down this path, they were throwing out all of these logical things that they placed into this that they sold. Now, Hamilton being a adventurous person in banking did recognize that he could grow a national bank. And this is what really came out of the Assumption Act, that they were going to start borrowing, and the end game was creating a national bank. What ended up happening, and all of these people who were, you know, looking at the bank as being this great opportunity so that the federal government could make interest on its own workings, what ended up happening, because John Adams and a lot of people became heavy investors. They put their money in this American bank. And after the turn of the century, and I don't know if it was after Hamilton was killed in his duel with Aaron Burr, or shortly thereafter, or right before, I believe it was afterwards, because Adams was well out of office. And I believe what ended up happening was that the bank went bankrupt. John Adams lost everything. A lot of people in America that were heavily invested in this bank, Jefferson was not one of them. And so John Adams was forced to go live with his son, John Quincy Adams, because he lost everything. He couldn't pay his debts. And so he was able to get back on his feet. But you got to remember, back in those days, they didn't have permanent emoluments for the positions. The president didn't make a retirement. When you stepped down, that was it. Your emoluments ended. Had they maintained an emolument where you were going to have a retirement and a pension and some benefits coming at the public trust or from the public purse, then what would have happened would they would have included in the Constitution, because this goes back to this concept of impeachment. If the president maintains permanent emoluments, that means that he should be equally removable at any point in time for his behavior if he has emoluments. In other words, if he's got a retirement, then that is on the table for being removed. You don't just get away with being a bad player and being able to keep your retirement as the president. Because that is a public service retirement. It's based on your good behavior. It's not like some other pensions that have a complete divorcement. That is an emolument. Why? Because you still bear the name and you go around as a former president speaking to world leaders. Military retirement, you walk around as some generals may have some positions of notoriety and so forth, and they may be able to, and they may be subject to possibly being removed. But the average enlisted or the average person that retires from the military, that is a pension. It's not an emolument. It's not a position. But once you get into these flag level positions in the military, we've aggrandized the military dangerously so to allow them to actually have these positions of power. When Colin Powell gets out and speaks, you know, he can actually make, you know, a president miserable, or he can or he can actually, you know, kind of smooth the feathers over or what have you. Well, who is he? He's just some schmuck that, you know, served in the military. Oh, but why is it that he's prominent? Because he received a station and received an acknowledgement. And as far as I'm concerned, when you get to that level in flag, you know, if you can get out and have a microphone put in your face because of your position, to me, that's an emolument. And one of the things I do know, because I had an uncle that was a general, and he was constantly going to D.C., getting briefed on terrorist tactics and intel briefings as a retired general. Why? Because these guys are threats. Now, down at the lower ranks, you know, we're not threatened by, you know, potential hostilities, not like they are. So anyway, I don't want to belabor the point, but bottom line. The federal government has the authority to take on debt. The only reason it can take on debt is for it to perform its job as it is enumerated in the Constitution. If it takes on debt that is for something that is not enumerated, that debt is fraud. It is fraudulent, it is defrauding the American people, and the American people are not actually on the hook for it legally. Even though the federal government is paying for it and saying we're on the hook for it and doing everything to make that seem legitimate, when the people and the states look at this and they evaluate it and they realize that they've been duped and we've been transferring wealth to all sorts of nations around the world unconstitutionally, it ends. The only thing that makes it end is Republic Review, because Republic Review in the audit process will prove that the federal government has no authority to exercise the Department of Education, the Department of Energy, the Department of, or the Environmental Protection Agency, all of these things that they have created, the CDC, Fauci's office, all of these things are outside the enumerated powers. They have no authority to be playing and doing these types of things at all. And we have to reel them in. And the way to do that is Republic Review. So we'll get into that once we're finished with the Whiskey Rebellion. Now, what we want to do is I want to set the stage, because right after they had the Assumption and finally passed the Assumption Act, I think it was towards the end of 1790, then they started looking at other opportunities that they might be able to help increase or build the economy in different parts of the Union. One of the problems that they were having was in the fisheries. As you know, Britain was harassing our ships. They were coming in and fishing in our cod fishery areas and so forth. And so what ended up happening was this concept of creating a bounty that the federal government was going to help supplement the cod fisheries by paying a bounty so that, you know, they could actually funnel money in and help bolster up this one part of the economy. And so this becomes a very contentious debate. It starts off with Mr. Livermore, then it goes to Mr. Lawrence, and then we're going to get into Mr. Madison. And Mr. Madison, I want to just kind of set the stage here. As these guys try to justify this need, as they try to justify, that was just a pen, by the way, falling. As they try to justify, you know, the importance and the benefit of doing all of this, Madison gets really plain and simple on them, and it basically puts it in context of the Constitution. It's not there. This is not an enumerated power. And then he uses shock value. And I am telling you, had we been in the halls of Congress when Madison was making some of these comments, you would have heard gasps. You would have heard people go, oh, why, did you hear what he just said? They're going to take over education. Because everybody cherished religious's responsibility. Because at that point in time, education and compassionate services, that was all being done and managed by the state's religious services. This is why I kind of went through this before. The states, the people, the bureaucrats weren't issuing out free money. You wanted money, you needed help, you got it from the church. You had health problems, what? You got it from the church. And the church was compassionate. And if those people who were living riotously and that just wanted to live, you know, and destroy themselves, they weren't going to help you. If you were drinking and you were, you know, being irresponsible, the church wanted to make you responsible first before they started really helping you get back on your feet. Because they looked at your responsibility and accountability to those kids of yours. Your behavior had to match those people who wanted to help you. Here are people wanting to help you, but not help you get drunk, help you get back on your feet to provide for your children. So anyway, if you can understand the merits and the beauty of our welfare system in the very beginning, where the churches were actually the administrators of that, because they were going into your home and they could see, they would understand what was going on. Today it's a bureaucracy. They give you a check, go get drunk, we don't care. That is immoral. And with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.